I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. What should you do if you get stopped by the police? Maybe you've made an illegal U-turn, or you've broken a more serious law, or maybe you were minding your own business and don't know why you were stopped. No matter what the case, there's a set of spoken and unspoken rules that govern how we interact with law enforcement. That's the topic of today's installment of our month-long series on criminal justice. With us, Catherine Lehman, Racial Justice Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and Jonathan Turley, Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having us on.
So, Catherine, let me start with you, and let me start with an example. Say that you're in a car with your friend who had been drinking at a bar. You've had a drink or two yourself, and you guys also have liquor in the car. Suddenly, the red lights start flashing, and your friend nervously pulls over. So what should you do? Run out of the car, refuse to get out of the car when asked to, or start talking about what you've been up to that night, or none of the above? What do you think?
I love these multiple-choice questions. Right back to law school. In general, my approach and the approach that I advise other people to take is to be as deferential as possible with the police and try to defuse any tensions that a police officer might bring to the situation. And in that situation, I would certainly not run from the car. I always advise people not to run from the police because the running, some courts have said that running gives the officers probable cause to go after you. So you would like to not do that in general. In that situation, I think I would politely ask the officer why I've been stopped. I would give the officer my name and the license and registration information for the car if I were the driver, and then I would wait for the officer to ask any further questions.
If the officer asked to breathalyze you, can you say no?
You can say no, and I would advise that people do say no. It may mean that you will end up at the station and that you will have a longer interaction with the police than if you agreed to a breathalyzer in the moment, but you don't have to do it right there on the street.
Jonathan, you know, this is not a conversation about drunk driving per se, but more about how you interact. So if you are a passenger in a car where someone has been drinking, or if you are with someone who you think has committed a crime and you're stopped together, in general, what kind of liability or responsibility might you bear as someone who's more of a bystander?
Well, it depends on what the alleged crime is. I mean, obviously, drinking and driving is an offense related to the driver. It is something that would not be imputed or vicariously imposed upon passengers. However, having open containers in a car is something that passengers could conceivably be charged with in some cases. And there are collateral or related crimes that they could bring as well. I think that the important thing is not to be confrontational, to be cooperative. Remember that if the police see conduct or behavior that is furtive or aggressive, they can use that as reasonable suspicion or even in some cases probable cause for more intrusive actions, possibly even putting someone under arrest. The important thing to remember as a passenger, you're not immediately guilty of anything. And so, for example, having a breathalyzer demanded from a passenger is a very odd thing for police to do, and there's no reason why a passenger needs to go through such a test.
Catherine, what about more serious crimes? I'm thinking about it. There have been several cases recently where it can be either partner, but specifically women, wives or girlfriends, have been sent to jail for not reporting the drug dealing activities of their partner or for doing things like laundering money. In a case where you are with someone that you know is committing a criminal act and it is of that magnitude, what kind of risk do you face and what kind of issues are on the table?
So it's a question, what kind of risk do you face when the police are in front of you and have stopped you or have come to your home, or is the question?
Or just in general. I mean, in this case, not when you're stopped, but if you were partnered or involved with someone who's committing a crime and you don't think that you're committing a crime, are there ever cases where you're liable?
Well, there are, and the kinds of cases that you've just talked about. And I think, you know, we normally think of guilt by association as something that is not really part of our criminal law. But there are instances in which you can be seen as part of a conspiracy or as part of a drug ring, for example, and there is some danger in continuing to associate with somebody whom you know to be engaged in criminal activity. Likewise, there are, as I'm sure many listeners know, a number of gang injunctions in effect around the country, and most of the people who are subject to those gang injunctions are not active gang members, but are people who are gang associates or hangers-on, which really means that they are residents in a neighborhood where there is an active gang. So there are a number of ways in which one can get swept up into potential criminal liability without engaging in what most of us consider particularly pernicious activity.
You're the racial justice director at the ACLU of Southern California. Do you think there's ever bias or misapplication of the laws that govern association with known criminals when it comes to race?
Sure. I am deeply upset about the existence of gang injunctions around the country. I think that they shouldn't be in use. I think that typically the police officers who are then enforcing those injunctions are overreaching. Most of the people who are subject to those injunctions are residents who live in low-income communities, and they tend to be all people of color, and they all are considered to be gang members by the officers who are working those beats, not necessarily because they are, in fact, active gang members. I have a number of clients and have litigated a number of cases that involve racial profiling. I hear stories about racial profiling nearly every day in my work, and I am deeply disturbed by the statistics I see in my local jurisdiction. I'm in Los Angeles among the LAPD and in the Sheriff's Department. I continue to see very serious instances of racial profiling that I find enormously upsetting.
Jonathan, along the same lines, how do you think the issue of racial profiling plays out on a practical level? I mean, there's the whole concept of driving while black, and it's come up in cases involving the Maryland Highway Patrol and many other places. If you feel that you've been pulled over without cause, what rights do you have?
Well, I think once again, you have to be careful not to take actions that would give the police reasonable suspicion or probable cause to take more aggressive action. And indeed, I know of plenty of cases. I'm a criminal defense attorney on the side, and I know of plenty of cases where police have indeed tried to get people to act that way. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're looking for something to ratchet up the encounter. People also need to recognize that the Supreme Court has made it easier for these types of stops to occur. In actually a case out of Washington, D.C., called Wren versus the United States, this was a 1996 case, the court actually upheld the right of police to use a pretext to stop someone. That it had long been viewed that the police had to have a legitimate reason to stop a car. But what the court said was, even though this group of detectives wasn't supposed to stop cars for traffic violations and minor issues, that they could, in fact, do that as a pretext. So it was perfectly clear in Wren that these were officers who were just using a minor traffic issue in order to stop a car, and from that encounter then ratchet up the matter and ultimately leading to a full arrest. So you do have a much more difficult situation now because of the Supreme Court's rulings. The court has also said that profiling is okay, while suggesting that pure racial profiling based entirely on race is not. But that doesn't help much, because the court has said that police officers can use profiles in order to get reasonable suspicion, or in some cases even probable cause.
Well, Jonathan, give me an example of what a profile might consist of in that case.
Well, you know, as someone who teaches in the area, I always have fun with my students because I give them profiles that we've seen in other cases where, for example, at airports, the police would say that the reason they stopped someone is because they were getting off the plane first and they wanted to know, what's your hurry? And in another case, they said the person held back and was last off the plane, and why was he holding back? And so all of these profiles can be pretty arbitrary and transparent. But there are plenty of standard profiles that they look to. They involve everything from having your lights off on a car at night to repeatedly passing by a location as if you're scoping out or looking for possible criminal activity. There are literally dozens of different things that the officers have cited. And these are all an effort to get away from race. It's very rare that an officer will honestly say, I stopped that guy because he was Hispanic or an African American. The other thing that, as I wanted to mention with the earlier hypothetical of being stopped or held when someone is busted in an apartment, once again, you need to be careful. The officers are allowed to detain everyone in the house while the arrest or a search is going on. So the important thing would be
true in cases where there would be marijuana or other drugs, as well as presumably other crimes that may have been alleged.
Yeah, the important thing is to keep a steady head. You're going to have to recognize that they have this authority. They also have the authority to pat down for their safety, and so you're going to have to expect that. That doesn't mean you're without your rights. It's just that if you get aggressive, the officers are going to quickly ratchet up the encounter and you're going to end up under arrest.
Catherine, let's go through. You mentioned in general that it's good to be deferential. But let's run through, you know, some tips, just generally two or three tips when it comes to being approached by the law.
Well, my number one tip is do not consent to a search of your person or your home. Unless, as Jonathan said, the officers have a warrant or probable cause or reasonable suspicion, they cannot search you and they cannot search your home unless you consent. And I am dismayed by the number of people who find themselves intimidated by the police into giving consent. Having said that, my number one caution is do not give consent. I think that there are circumstances under which one might elect to give consent. So let me say what those are. If you are positive that you are the only person who has been in your car and might have put anything in your car, or the only person who's using your apartment, and you're positive that there is, you know, nothing illegal, that you're not engaged in any illegal activity, and you have reason to trust the officer who is in front of you or the department that you are subject to, then you can make things speedier by consenting. But I think that those circumstances are rare. And the more common course of prudence would be not to consent. It can be scary not to consent. Often officers, it's speedier for the officer if you do consent. And so often officers try to intimidate people into giving consent. But it is generally the course of prudence not to do it. You also should know that you don't need to answer an officer's questions unless you are, in fact, under arrest. And so if an officer stops you on the street and begins to ask questions, you can ask if you are free to go. And if the officer says yes, then walk away. And you can say, I don't want to talk right now. I think in general it's a good idea to protect yourself and to be very cautious about what information you share with an officer.
Let me get Jonathan in here. I want to ask you specifically, Jonathan, about Miranda rights. I know there have been some recent rulings that I believe may diminish the grounds that you have to have the right to remain silent, speech delivered. What are the changes that have happened in Miranda rights?
Well, you know, there was a considerable surprise for many of us when the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Rehnquist ruled that Miranda was constitutionally based, because until very recently, There was a great debate as to whether it was even a constitutional doctrine. But, you know, when they did ultimately say, all right, it is constitutionally based, they had already made so many exceptions to Miranda that there were more holes than cheese in the doctrine. And so, first of all, Miranda protects you from having statements being used at court. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. And so even when you have a Miranda violation, it does not mean necessarily that you're going to see the case dropped. Second, Miranda is something that can be easily waived, and you have to be very careful. Officers know that people don't like to invoke their right to remain silent because it makes them look like they're guilty. But people also need to recognize that there are great perils, even when you're innocent, if you are the suspect of a crime. And so it is always better, if you are a suspect of a crime, to speak with an attorney. By the time people realize that, it's often too late, and we can't make this cat walk backwards because you've already waived your Miranda rights. So they will state Miranda to you, and they will ask you expressly whether you waive the right to remain silent and to seek counsel.
Well, Jonathan, we have to wrap it up there, but Jonathan and Catherine, I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Great pleasure.
Jonathan is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University, and Catherine is the racial justice director of the ACLU of Southern California. And that is News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits, and Kenya Young is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell and Don Spalding are our drive engineers. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, Devin Robbins, Ernest Champel, Noor Akkad, and Anthea Raymond. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. North Carolina and Indiana get a lot of juice for their basketball teams, but this year they have got game in the political arena. Next week, a look at the contest in the Hoosier and Tar Heel states. Thank you.